This CKNW podcast is brought to you by Destination Toyota in Burnaby. Open all the time at burnabytoyota.ca.
And welcome to this week's show. I've been promoting the fact that Jeff Rubin, former chief economist from CIBC, is going to be joining me talking about oil and how it impacts our lives and a forecast for what we could be looking at 10 years down the road. Here's the first part of my interview with Jeffrey Rubin. First of all, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Now, you have two very important books. The first one came out in 2009, Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, and I refer to it a lot on this radio show. And your thesis in that book was talking about, you know, and you referred a lot to the amount of energy that's available in the world, and we were going through a recession, and when the economy starts to pick up again, the pipe is only so big, how much oil they can push through the pipe, but the demand is going to grow. In your second book now called The End of Growth, you don't refer too much to, you do refer to the fact that the oil that we have in the ground is harder to get out, but you didn't refer too much to peak oil and the fact that we're going to not be able to find oil. In your second book, you say there's going to be oil, but it's going to be a whole lot more expensive.
Yeah, I guess my take on peak oil is a little bit different than others. It's traditionally a geological concept to mean that the world will peak production at XX million barrels a day. I mean, I don't really think that's the helpful way to look at it. I think peak oil is not what you can drill, but rather what you can afford to burn. Like, it doesn't matter if there's 170 billion barrels of oil in the Alberta tar sands or over 250 billion in the Venezuela's Orinoco tar sands. If the price needed to get the oil out of the tar is the same price that causes millions of motorists to get off the road, and worse than that, causes oil-consuming economies to keel over and go back into recession. So, you know, if peak oil is really a demand phenomena, if it's defined by what economies can afford to burn, I think we're there. Because I think when we get into a world of triple-digit oil prices, our economies don't grow, or they grow at a fraction of the pace that they grew 10 years ago when oil was $20 a barrel.
So what you're saying is every time the economy heats up, the price of oil heats up as well. Because we're seeing that with the Greek crisis now. The price of oil is falling because people are worried that we're heading into a recession. So this up and down is what you think we're going to go through for quite a while.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, oil prices will fall in the coming recession, just like they fell in the last one. Oil prices fell as low as $40 a barrel. But ironically, oil was never more scarce, because when oil is $40 a barrel, you start shutting in millions of barrels of production, including the Canadian tar sands, because it doesn't make any economic sense. In fact, they canned about $50 billion of CapEx in Fort McMurray when oil prices got to 2009. Unfortunately, what happens is the minute that we see an economic recovery, like a jack-in-the-box, global oil demand recovers, and boom, we're looking at the same triple-digit oil prices that led to the recession in the first place. And that's essentially what's happened this time around. As early as January 2011, Brent, which is the world oil price, has been in triple-digit range and has only now come down, and only now coming down because, of course, recessions are rolling across Europe.
But there could be an argument made that the European cities, for the most part, were built before the advent of the automobile. So you have densely populated urban centers, transportation built before there was mass automobile ownership. So they have a lot of that infrastructure, and you don't get the bitterly cold winters that we have. So what would you say to somebody who lives in Oshawa, Ontario, and has to drive to downtown Toronto, or lives in Maple Ridge, British Columbia, and has to drive to downtown Vancouver to work? What do you say to them? These are new cities. These are North American cities built on the car.
Right, but let's also understand what's driven their architecture. The far-flung suburban sprawl is a function of rates of car ownership and cheap gasoline. Those cities are going to have to be re-engineered. I fully understand that you know, riding your bike to work can't be like the equivalent of a triathlon. You know, if it's going to be
viable. We'd all be in great shape.
If it's going to be a viable alternative, but maybe cities will shrink back into their bike size when gasoline is $2 a liter. The challenge is going to be to provide the kind of capital for public transport infrastructure that will be required. And in my first book, I questioned why we, instead of bailing out auto companies to the tunes of billions of dollars so that they could build plants in China, why we wouldn't better have been served by investing that money in public transit. And I think that argument would have been as valid for Obama in the States as it would have been for Harper and McGuinty in Canada. It's not an accident that you have suburban sprawl in North America and you don't in Europe. That's a function of different energy prices. And I think that we'll see increasing energy density. We'll certainly see increasing public transit. And maybe, you know, maybe we need to see more toll roads, because in the future that I envision, driving is going to go back to what it originally was, something that only affluent people do. And if that becomes the case, why should average taxpayers be paying for roads and bridges? Why don't, you know, if only the affluent are going to drive, let them pay for their own roads through toll bridges and roads, and taxes go to funding public transit.
So do you see in the future, what price is going to make this happen, by the way? People giving up their lifestyle farther away from urban centers and maybe moving closer to a smaller home and going from two cars to one, or even getting rid of other cars altogether. So what's the threshold price, do you think?
I mean, it's not just one price, because a lot of things start happening. The prices of real estate start to change. As people start to want to live closer to where they work, maybe all of a sudden increasing density raises the real estate value of inner city properties.
We're seeing that in Toronto right now.
Slums, right? Yeah, all of a sudden, yeah. You know, and at the same time.
Well, look at, I guess a good example of that is in Manhattan, right? You have Harlem that used to be one of the worst areas in Manhattan to live in. Now it's gentrification. People are moving there.
So who's to say the same doesn't happen to Regent Park in downtown Toronto here, for example? At the same time, maybe those far-flung suburbs, they'll start to go down in value. There'll be less and less people willing to live out there. And at the same time, you know, the rising cost of fuel and the rising cost of transport is going to mean that we're not going to be flying our food in from halfway around the world. Food prices are going to rise, and maybe some of those far-flung suburbs just might be returned to the farms that they were only 30, 40 years ago.
Jeffrey Rubin is my guest. His latest book has just come out. It's called The End of Growth, But Is It All Bad? It's written at the bottom in small print, I should mention. We're going to give a couple of these copies away later in the show. Next, we're going to talk more about cars, the booming car business in China, and how that's going to affect us here in North America next on Driving. Hey, and welcome back to the show. ADESA Richmond Public Auction is where people can go and can sign their vehicle to be sold at auction. If you've never seen it in action, it is awesome. And I bring Mark Bergevin on every week to talk about a car that's gone across the block and is a good news story. So, Mark, I've seen the auction in action, and what's this one all about this week?
Well, this one's a 2005 Jeep Liberty, so an SUV. The customer had, you know, they've dealt with us in the past. So this is a repeat customer bringing in their vehicle here. They bring the vehicle in. So it's kind of an easy deal. But the good news about this story, Zach, is they brought the vehicle in good and early, giving us plenty of time to prepare it, showcase it, get it online with some pictures, and make sure that it's in our run list so, you know, the vehicle's can be promoted. And then what happened is we appraised the vehicle for $6,500. They chose to put a reserve of $7,000 on the vehicle, and lo and behold, Zach, it brought 6,900 cars sold off. Good news story.
All right. Now, the thing is, you do have the option at ADESA to take the car in and get it polished and clean, get the windshield chips fixed, all that kind of stuff you do, right?
Absolutely, and we can do that for any vehicle for sure, yes.
And it makes sense, because when a car goes across the block, if it looks good, it helps sell.
It's like anything, Zach. The better you make it look, the better odds there are of a good return.
All right. Thanks, Mark. We'll speak to you next week.
Thanks, Zach.
We continue our conversation with Jeff Rubin, the author of The End of Growth, How Oil is Going to Affect Our Lives Moving Forward. Now, it's interesting, even in light of recent fuel prices being, you know, as high as I filled up at $1.57 a liter about a week and a half ago. But small, subcompact, very fuel-efficient cars are not selling. In fact, their sales are down in Canada. The sales of, compact SUVs, things like the Toyota RAV4 and the Honda CR-V, these are the vehicles that people want because they like the size and the all-wheel drive and all of those sorts of things. So even in light of your thesis that, you know, people will move away from bigger vehicles to smaller vehicles because of the price, we're not seeing that in our Canadian market. How do you explain that phenomenon?
Well, you know, we're still, how long have we been living in a world of triple-digit fuel prices? Maybe for 3-4 years. Many people think that that's an aberration, that's something that the energy industry is going to quickly turn around and solve. But I'm just saying, economic choices are going to be made for people. It's going to be made for people not only in the price of fuel, but also in the rate at which our economies grow, and hence the incomes that consumers are going to have at their disposal. And I think, as I've argued in my new book, The End of Growth, driving is going to become, if you look at it globally, more and more what economists call zero sum. That is, that if somebody gets on the road in India and China, pretty soon somebody's coming off the road somewhere else.
So you say that with the huge growth, here's an interesting number. In the month of May, do you know how many cars were sold in China? You probably know, maybe. Take a guess.
I'm guessing they're running somewhere around at an annual rate of 18, 19 million a year.
Yeah, so 1.2 million cars sold in 1 month. The Canadian marketplace for a whole year is about 1.5 to 1.6. So they're almost selling in 1 month in China what all Canadians buy in a year, which is mind-boggling.
Right, and, you know, I mean, they've long now surpassed the U.S. market, and I get back to my earlier comment that, you know, I mean, where is General Motors, you know, building plants?
Yeah.
They're building plants in China, so, you know, why are we financing them? Because they're not building plants in North America. In fact, they're just going to be shutting down an operation, a whole production line in Oshawa. I think, you know, where you're going to see tomorrow's drivers are in China and India, and not only, and, you know, because of the price of gasoline, but also the price of a car, that, you know, car ownership is becoming much more accessible to those people as, you know, Tata makes a Nano that can sell for as little as $5,000. But realize also that every new, you know, Tata owner or Chery owner in India and China gets a straw to start sucking at a world fuel supply that's really not growing very quickly. And guess what? The more that they suck, the less is going to be available here and the higher the price. And that's basically what's happening.
I found it interesting in your book, you referred to the fact that this emerging middle class you have in these huge countries are not used to paying for fuel. So now that they're filling up their new whatever car, they don't really have a reference point.
Right. I mean, it's not the price of fuel so much as the price of a car, okay, and their incomes. And when you combine rapid income growth experienced by the burgeoning middle income classes in China and India with how rapidly the price of a car has fallen, then I think you've got, you know, a whole different demand dynamic than you have here. I mean, these people aren't trading in their own clunker. They're trading in a pair of running shoes because they were walking or a bike, okay? And that's really a transformative event in their life and a whole different demand dynamic than over here where it's a question of, do I trade in my 8-year-old car for something sporty or more modern? And I think you'll find that the forces driving growing car ownership in China are different than the forces governing auto sales in places like Canada and the United States.
So you have higher fuel prices in Canada, and we're focusing, I mean, there's a lot in your book, it's a great book, but we're focusing on automotive because this is an automotive show. So what about the argument that says, okay, what about if we start switching, and it's easily done with the internal combustion engine to natural gas. Natural gas is at all-time lows for the price, and there's an abundance of it. They're doing all of this fracking in places around North America to get more oil out of the ground, but the side effect is more natural gas.
Right.
So can't we just switch to that?
Well, I mean, if you look at the price disparity between natural gas and oil, and it's huge, it would be arbitraged in a nanosecond if, in fact, they were substitutes. But they're not substitutes. I mean, there's a reason why we use oil as a transit fuel. And not just in cars or trucks, but in planes and boats. Because it packs four times the energy density of natural gas. Now, you could get, you know, LNG, liquefied natural gas, that gets up to about 60% of the energy density of oil. But, of course, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to convert natural gas into liquid form. There are natural gas vehicles. I mean, many of the taxis run on natural gas. Just don't.
Yeah, Ford in the 90s had a fleet of vehicles you could get directly from the factory.
Right, but just don't be taking one of those taxis to the airport with a lot of luggage, because half of the trunk is the gas tank, and we get back to energy density. You know, it may make sense where the size of the fuel tank doesn't matter in heavy trucks. Of course, the question will be, will there be a distribution system to fill up? But right now, out of something like 240 million vehicles on the road in North America, less than a million really are driven by anything other than oil. So, I mean, right now we're basically looking at oil as the transit fuel, and I think that instead of the solution being some magic fuel, the solution really is on the demand side. We're just going to have to drive less, and that's exactly what higher gasoline prices are going to lead us to do.
We're speaking with Jeff Rubin, the author of The End of Growth. More of our conversation next on driving. And welcome back to the show. Don't forget, if you ever want to go to my website, motormouth.ca, there's old radio shows up there, there's previous interviews, there's lots of newspaper articles, there's videos, and a whole lot more. And you can just go there anytime and check it out. It's a great resource if you're in the market for a new product. We return now our conversation with Jeff Rubin, former chief economist for CIBC. This is his second book. It's called The End of Growth. And I'm basically trying to drill down with Jeff Rubin about how it's going to impact us in the automotive world. What is our future going to look like? And continue our conversation with Jeff Rubin on driving. Now, before the break, you talked about North Americans changing their attitudes and driving less as fuel prices go up. Is there one area in the world where you can point to and say, this is the model?
Well, I think Denmark's the model, not for the reasons that the Danes would have you believe it, but for the real reasons, which is energy prices. And there's two aspects to Denmark that I'd mention. One is carbon emissions. Their emissions are actually lower than their 1990 levels. They've actually lived up to their Kyoto Treaty commitments. Canada, on the other hand, we were about 30% above when we decided we would, instead of paying the fine, just leave Kyoto. But, you know, Denmark would have you believe that the reason that they emit so much less is because a world leading 20% of their power is from wind. What they don't tell you is where the other 80% comes from. And the other 80% comes from coal, which is the dirtiest of the hydrocarbons. And basically, it's the same percentage as coal would play in China's grid, whose emissions are growing exponentially. So the immediate question is, how is Denmark able to reduce its emissions when it relies so heavily on coal? And the answer is not the source of power. The answer is the price of power. Because whether your lights are powered by wind power or by coal, you pay 30 cents per kilowatt hour, and that's 3 to 4 times what you pay in Canada. And lo and behold, households in Copenhagen use about 30% less electricity than households in Canada. Similarly, you see everybody riding a bike in Denmark. I mean, they even have separate traffic lights for bicycles. And you wonder why. And it's not so much the price of fuel. It's more expensive than in Canada, but no more so than in other places in Europe. It's rather the price of buying a car, because depending on how many horses are under the hood, if you have like a V8 engine, you would pay 180% surcharge on that car.
Okay, so if it's a $100,000 car, you'd pay $180,000 tax?
That's exactly right.
Wow.
So that car all of a sudden is $280,000 instead of $100,000. Dare I say that even with our weather, if we put 180% surcharge on cars, you'd see a lot more folk driving a bike here. Now, in Toronto, my hometown, the new mayor couldn't even live with a $65 tax on car ownership, let alone 180% surcharge. Now, let's remember a couple of differences here. Denmark doesn't have a huge auto assembly industry. When Denmark kills demand for cars, it's some German auto worker who loses his job, not some auto worker in Oshawa or Oakville.
But back to your book, is that that doesn't shift. The German auto worker is still working. He's just working for somebody buying a car in China.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. The good news story is, hey, you don't have to be suited for wind power, because dare I say that Alberta or Montana could reduce its carbon emissions without erecting one single wind turbine if they too charge 30 cents per kilowatt per hour, because then people in Montana and Alberta would use less power, and hence less hydrocarbons would be combusted. Similarly, you know, we can get a lot of people on bikes if we want to tax car ownership the way we do. But, you know, it's going to be obviously a lot more difficult to do that in Ontario than to do it in Denmark.
Well, that's political suicide. I mean, any politician comes out and says, I'm going to raise your taxes and get you out of your nice plush car and onto a bike on a cold spring morning, they're not getting elected.
Yeah, but here's what I'm saying. I mean, we're going to be paying these prices not because of politicians imposing them, but because fuel scarcity is going to dictate that. But in answering how we will respond to that fuel scarcity, let's look at how the Danes have responded to policy choices they made. Now, why did they make those policy choices? They don't have hydrocarbons. Like, if the tar sands was in Copenhagen, they may have totally different economic policies.
I can bet you they would.
Denmark. It's only the capriciousness of nature that determines, you know, who has hydrocarbons, who doesn't, and that determines what kind of policies make sense, what doesn't. Look at Japan. I mean, Japan went nuclear after the first OPEC oil embargo because they were so dependent. I mean, they are a country that consumes 4.5 million barrels a day that produces less than 100,000. But what's amazing about Japan is that since the nuclear disaster, in the space of little more than a year, they have shut down all their nuclear power generating stations, over 50 of them, and they've gone from 30% nuclear to zero. So it just shows what can happen when people decide that for whatever sets of reasons, they have to consume less energy, that it doesn't necessarily mean going back into the Stone Age.
What do you say is the number? What's the number, do you think? So we have efficiencies that we can still extract from cars. I know that because I test drive them all the time. There are plenty of new cars today that are 20-30% more efficient than maybe your... I think you have a 9-year-old car, right?
I have a 12-year-old car.
Yeah, so you have a 12-year-old Audi. I could put you in a new Audi, and it's going to get 20-30% greater efficiency than the one you have. So we still have efficiencies to gain by getting new technology.
We do, but it doesn't seem to be getting us to where we want to go. And forget about my 12-year-old Audi. What about, like, the 30-year-old Buick LeSabre that my dad used to drive? Curiously enough, the average vehicle today consumes just as much fuel as it does in the 1970s, because what have we done with all those fuel efficiencies? We're now driving much bigger cars. You yourself point out it's the SUVs that are still selling, not the subcompacts. We've loaded in all kinds of fuel-sucking options as standard, like what car doesn't come with air conditioning and power everything? And most importantly, the distance we drive is greater because, of course, we live now farther and farther out in the suburbs. So all those fuel efficiencies, what have we done with that? We've just consumed them all in driving more. So that's, of course, the efficiency paradox, that we allow ourselves to consume the efficiencies, it lowers the price of driving, and we end up driving more. Now, with $2 a liter gasoline, we won't have that option anymore.
Do you think that's the magic number? I remember you were the one who, there was a famous Time magazine cover, $200 barrel of oil.
Well, you know, we don't need $200 barrel oil, because I think what we've all discovered is even oil in the triple digit levels, even, I mean, that would have been unthinkable 5 years ago. But I think Brent only got as high this time around as 127. It's averaged well over 100 the last year. And just look where the global economy is. Because, you know, you look at all the debt around, and you look, you know, countries like Greece and Portugal and Spain not being able to service their debt. all that debt might as well be denominated in barrels of oil, because the only way these economies can service that debt is by growing. And the only problem is that the minute they begin to grow, they've got to start burning more and more barrels of oil, and the higher demand goes, the higher the price goes, and ultimately we just can't afford to grow at those prices.
We're speaking with Jeff Rubin, the author of the book The End of Growth. His two books have been bestsellers in Canada, and now's your chance to win a copy. We have two copies to give away. All you need to do is go to my website, motormouth.ca, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see an email tab. Click on that and fill in the form and send it off. The first two emails I get will win a copy of Jeff Rubin's book, The End of Growth. We'll continue with an update from newcarselloff.com on our final segment with Jeff Rubin, the author of The End of Growth. And welcome back to the show. Each and every week, we speak with Rick Balkin from New Car Sell-Off. Brand new cars with full warranty at deeply discounted prices. And after 5 months of being around, you've modified the site. What's new with newcarselloff.com?
Well, customer feedback that we've received has asked us to make it an easier search process for them. So what we've done, Zach, is we've actually been able to sort by model now, as opposed to just by make and type. And also, we've also refined the search so that you can, in fact, search by the province that you're in. So again, you can still search in terms of across the board for the best possible deal, but people have asked us to make it so that they can search in their own province for a specific model, and that's what we've done.
Anything else that's new?
Yeah, we actually put a filter by demonstrators in. So, for example, if you don't want to search a vehicle that has miles on it, because some of these vehicles that we have posted are, in fact, company demonstrators, but they still are brand new, you can click that button so that those vehicles are excluded from the search.
Or included.
Or included, yeah. Some of the best deals, in fact, are on those demonstrators.
Yeah, and I would never shy away from a demonstrator because they have to really discount in order to move a car that's already got kilometers on it. That's a good deal.
You bet.
So anything else going on at newcarselloff.com? Like, why are dealers trying to discount these cars?
Well, again, it comes down to the fact they've got too many of one type, maybe a vehicle in their particular zone that doesn't work that they want to clear out. Or maybe, in fact, it's last year's model car that just for some reason or another hasn't sold. It's perfectly fine, but it just hasn't sold for one reason or another.
And the warranty only kicks in on a brand new car when the vehicle is registered. So even if the car has been sitting on the dealer's lot for 6 or 8 months, as soon as it's registered in your name, that's when the warranty kicks in, right?
That's right. And you get the benefit of the full warranty, so it's a brand new vehicle that you're purchasing at a completely discounted price.
All right, newcarselloff.com. And when you're on there, if, for example, the car is out of your geographical area, you can also have the vehicle shipped right to your door. That's Rick Balkin from newcarselloff.com. Rick, I'll speak to you next week.
Thanks, Zach.
This week, we're speaking with economist and author Jeff Rubin about his book, The End of Growth.
So an economist's job, at the heart of the matter, is to predict the future, or with as much skill as possible.
I think, you know, in the next decade, our economy is going to change in many fundamental respects and resemble probably more the economy of the past than the economy that we've known. We're going to see the return of local economy. We're not going to be accessing things made halfway around the world, because what we're going to find is that what we used to save on wages, we're going to more than squander on bunker fuel and transport costs. We're going to see more tool and die workers, more manufacturing jobs. We're going to see more of the land turned back into farming. At the same time, we're probably going to have less hedge fund managers.
And is that a bad thing?
Less investment bankers. I think that, you know, we're going to find that nothing really changed since the last subprime mortgage crisis, when we're all going to own a little piece of Greece and Spain when they default, and the kind of financial market reforms that we should have seen after the last crisis we'll probably see this time around, and it'll shrink the financial sector. I think we're going to see people live in greater density. I think we're going to see people live closer to where they work. I think we're going to see car ownership rates decline. I don't think, you know, today's teenager is automatically going to drive like they did 30 years ago. And I think we're going to see people ultimately drive different types of vehicles. Certainly, fuel economy is going to become more important in the choices of vehicles that we drive today than it probably has since the OPEC oil shocks.
So is this good news for the Rust Belt, you know, Hamilton, Southern Ontario, Michigan, Cleveland? Like, all of this infrastructure was built through the massive industry that happened over the last 100 years. There's rail lines there. There's shipping lines there. There's all that stuff there. Can these economies revive and build factories to service areas closer to home?
I think they will. And who would have ever dreamt that triple-digit oil prices would breathe new life into our hollowed out rust belt? But that's what the transport costs that come out of triple digit oil prices do, that it doesn't make any sense for us to import steel from China when oil's $100 a barrel. Now, how much of that steel industry will come back to Pittsburgh versus Hamilton? It's going to depend very much on the Canadian dollar and very much on the development of the Alberta tar sands. But there's no question that local manufacturing is going to get a brand new lease on life in this world of high transport costs.
What do you think the outlook is for Canada? You have a huge energy resource there in Alberta that the world wants. China wants it. The U.S. wants it. Those pipelines are going to get made, one or the other or both, because they want that oil. So is that not a net positive for the country in terms of wealth to be able to pay for health care and all those things?
Well, you know, I guess it will depend on which part of the country you live in. It's not an accident that GM just announced another production line is cut in Oshawa and moving that back to the States. I think what we're going to find is that the more barrels of oil we can pump out of the tar sands, the less cars we're going to manufacture in Canada, because the higher the exchange rate is going to be.
So the dollar will go up above parity and they'll want to move manufacturing south.
That's right. So, I think going forward that the major fault lines in this country is not going to be between East and West or between English and French. It's going to be between those that have oil and those that have not. And, you know, that's going to make common cause between Alberta and Newfoundland, just as it's going to make common cause between Ontario and Quebec. And, you know, there's no real higher moral ground here. It's just going to depend, you know, it's, as I say, the capriciousness of nature that, you know, dealt the tar sands to Alberta instead of the Annapolis Valley in Nova Scotia. But nevertheless, I think we're going to see the major schisms, political debates, economic antagonism in the country very much centered around oil.
Now, what would you say to my listeners who are in their car maybe right now and they're driving their, you know, whatever it is, and what do you say to them? 10 years
don't
from now,
be
20
like
years.
Me. Don't drive a 12-year-old car and think you're saving money. Because to keep a 12-year-old Audi on the road ain't cheap. It's just that I love driving a stick, and they've stopped making sticks in Audis unless you get the souped-up RS versions.
Which really sucks,
and
Gas.
I think that would be a little off message for me, even though I'd love to drive one.
Now, what about electric cars and more hybrids? And,
yeah.
And because you, in your first book, Why Your World Is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, you talk about the energy to extract things and make batteries, and there's only so much energy out there. Oil is a great source. It's a fabulous source
that's
of energy.
That's why we use it, and that's why we use it as a transit fuel. I mean, sure, we can use more electric cars, and hopefully we will, but let's not forget that a battery is not a source of power. Somewhere there has to be a coal-generating plant or a nuclear power plant or a natural gas fired power plant to create that energy. Now, if, you know, 240 million cars all of a sudden tried to plug in their batteries, guess what? The lights go out. Because I remember about 9-10 years ago, one too many air conditioners here in the city went dark. So, you know, again, there is going to be a role for natural gas to play a larger role, for battery powered cars, it's biodiesel. But again, stepping back and looking at the big picture here and our challenge, instead of trying to figure out how to turn cow shit into high octane fuel, we're just going to have to learn to drive less.
Jeff Rubin, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed both your books, and it's been a great pleasure meeting you.
Take care. It's great talking to you.
My thanks to Jeff Rubin for joining me this week. I'm Zach Spencer. That's all the time we have. Speak to you next week on Driving.